Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're here to render judgment on the worlds of celebrity, pop culture, television, and fashion.
Strap yourselves in for some hardcore opinionating, darlings.
This is Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're Tom and Lorenzo.
And this is the Pop Style Opinion Fest. Hello, kittens. Welcome back to another edition of the PSO. I am the Tino Tilo, Tom Fitzgerald. I'm here with the Low and your Tilo, Lorenzo Marquez, my lovely husband.
Hello,
Lorenzo. Say hello to the nice people.
I'm saying hello.
Stop looking at our recording equipment. I always say, like, we have to run an entire, like, radio show simultaneously. We have to produce it. We have to do the technical stuff. We have to do the live reads, and we have to do the banter. But anyway, Lorenzo, we are freezing.
I was just about to say, my God,
my God. The windows of Tilo Manor are rattling with the cold this morning. It is ridiculous this week, and I hate it.
I know.
This may be the third day in a row that I'm not going to the gym because it's just ridiculously cold.
I'm going. I don't know about you.
And you know what? I was like, well, I've got a lot to do right now. And I did miss 2 days in a row. And then I went and looked at the weather forecast for today. And it's like, you know, wind chill of 5 degrees.
Not anymore. Anyway.
That's not true. And all I can think is, I'm not training for the Olympics here. Why would I do that? Why would I go out in 5 degree weather? I don't want to, you know, get behind on my workout, but that's cray. and if you're going out today, I am bundling you up like a child.
Like
in the
a present.
Snow. Yes. anyway. We have another potpourri. Yeah, I'm going to zip you up like in a little snowsuit. So you can't move.
Oh my God. I'm just going to wobble.
Yeah. We're going to roll you to the gym. Okay. So we have yet another potpourri for you this week in the sense that it's just another smorgasbord of topics on a bunch of different things. Some are not the freshest topics in the world. We weren't even sure if we were going to talk about Rent Live because it was like 5 or 6 days ago. But we found, like, oh, what the hell, we'll still talk about it. We wrote a review of it, but it's been on our minds.
We can't keep up with all the things that are happening.
Oh, I know. There's so much going on. Also want to talk about a little bit about politics and fashion again. Just some news came out today about the State of the Union and how the women are urging other women to dress. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Also, Empire actor Jussie Smollett was gay-bashed this week, apparently. He was the victim of a hate crime. It was a gay and racist hate crime. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, about how that sort of ripples outward and affects lots of communities and what we have observed about the online response to it, which is a bit ominous. Anyway, let's start with Rent Live. Lorenzo, I wrote a review on Monday, so let's hear what you thought of the entire thing. You're not a Rent head.
No, I'm not. But the thing is that when I started dating you, you were, for some reason, I don't know why, but you were playing the CD.
Summer we started dating was the summer that it played in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think that was it.
And I saw the play for the first time that summer. I don't mean to talk over you, but you sometimes characterize me as some huge Rent fan, and that's not the case at all.
Well, it was playing 24/7
that summer, 22 years ago.
So.
And I this week, because of Rent Live, I actually had to go through our old iTunes library to even see if we still had it, the OBC, the original Broadway cast recording, which I used to play nonstop for that one summer. Anyway.
So my point
I found it, and I hadn't played it in 10 years at least. But go ahead.
My point is that I've never seen the play, but I know all the songs.
Right.
Because
I heard
them so many times. So I was excited. I was very, very excited about Valentina because I really like Valentina, and I think she was perfect. When they cast her, I thought she would be perfect to play Angel. At the time, I thought. Anyway.
I'll keep going. I have different thoughts, but go ahead.
But anyway, maybe I was just excited that she was cast. But anyway, they did such a, you know, Peter Pan was a disaster, but it felt like they kept improving the live shows, the live events. So I was very excited about Rent.
Rocky Horror was bad. Grease wasn't great. It was an up and down sort
of
thing.
And I I was never into Rent, truthfully, because I saw the movie and I hated the movie, and you didn't like the movie either. Mm-hmm. I find the story very dated.
And let's put it out here that you are a classically trained musician.
Right, exactly. But that doesn't mean much.
It does.
Okay.
I feel it does because this is why I don't claim to be a Rent head, is because I can look at Rent and say, okay, that is a underdeveloped work. Mm-hmm. And there are parts of it that are just not good, either from a musical direction or from a playwriting, you know, dramatic direction. The lyrics are infamously bad at certain points.
Right. I mean, I remember.
I still love huge parts of Rent.
Right.
And go ahead. You keep
going. I remember when the movie came out, there were some documentaries out there about the process of the creative, you know.
Well, he died. He died on opening night. So right. It never got to be... Fully, further finessed, right. It's locked into his vision.
But my point is that I remember watching the documentaries and thinking, my God, this is so raw. This is so unfinished.
It's very raw.
But for some reason, it took off in New York on Broadway, right. And it just became this huge, massive success. But it felt like it was never finished because, you know, the guy died, unfortunately,
right.
Before he could, you know, I don't know, fine-tune it or something. But I do like that it's raw. I do like that it's kind of raw and it's kind of like these fucked up people in a way.
Can I talk or
getting together or being friends and being a group? And I remember when I was much, much younger and we didn't have a lot of money but we had friends and we were colorful,
right. Right.
And then we had things to say and to do with no money,
right.
And we were creative. And we got together and, you know, people had problems, issues, but we were together. So I do relate to that. And I think it's a beautiful story when it comes to that. And that they touch in, you know, important issues, especially at the time. Still important, but especially at the time. The AIDS issue and all these things. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting story, but yet it's kind of dated. The way it's presented, let me put it this way.
Okay. And I agree with most of you on that. I agree with you on most of that. My goodness, had a minor little stroke there on the air. Yes, the problem with Rent when you get moved further away from when Rent was a phenomenon is that you get to see it without all of the emotional baggage,
right.
Of why it was a phenomenon. You said you didn't know why it took off. It took off because the guy died the night before opening night. It became a legend. The cast went on and gave this electrifying performance in his memory, and it just wowed the press. And let us remember that the tagline, it was on every taxi cab in New York for 5 years. No day but today, which is a line from...
I know.
And
it's a great song.
When that's the tagline for the show and the director died, or the playwright died, it's too perfect. It's too perfect a storm. Mm-hmm. It was, looking back on it 22 years later or whatever, it's like, I can look at it and go, yeah, of course that became a phenomenon. Regardless of the quality of the play, that story was not to
right.
be... you couldn't not be caught up in that. Having said that... as someone who really does know the lyrics and the song and the book of the show really, really well, because I did play it for so long, I know it's flawed. It's deeply flawed. I know that the character work doesn't make a lot of sense. I know that the show, the story does not take a critical look at any of these characters. It's way too fawning a look at all of them and never really... questions, and a lot of what these characters do is highly questionable. The whole thing is hinged on the idea that they don't feel like they should have to pay rent or get jobs. And at no point does the play or the story ever truly question them on this fact. The only people who think otherwise are quote unquote evil characters. You know, and it's little things like that, or little things like Angel's character gets introduced to the audience with a light poppy dance song about how he tortured a dog to death. I don't think that would fly
right.
past, you know, tryouts. I think all of that stuff would have gotten finessed or changed a bit had the show had chances to be developed further. But because of Jonathan Larson's memory and because of this dramatic way that his life ended in the middle of this project, no one wants to touch this show. No one wants to do anything to look at the lyrics, look at the staging, maybe have things done slightly differently to get to a different point from 25 years after it's set, you know, or almost 30 years after it's set. That's why it feels so dated. Nobody is allowed to look at it. Nobody's allowed to touch it. Chicago is not the exact same show it was the first time it was mounted. Cabaret is not the exact same. These shows they change over time. Directors find different nuances in staging and they change the sets or the costumes. And it was the other thing. They barely changed a stitch of the costumes on the show because that's the thing on Rent Live, of all of these live productions. They don't want to examine these things or move them forward. They want to replicate them. Karaoke. It's Broadway karaoke. And that's fine. I actually have no problem with that because it puts these shows in front of large audiences. It puts these shows in front of young audiences. So that's fine. If they want to stage a like cosplay karaoke version of Rent, that's fine.
Right.
But watching it now, 22 years after I first saw it, and of course much older, 22 years older, the flaws of the show are so obvious to me now.
Right. I do also think that when it comes to these live performances, I think because they want a lot of people watching it and they want draw a lot of fans and attention to the show, so they go for famous people, you know, famous people, famous names, instead of like a Broadway production when most of the time they pick people because they're very, very talented.
Right.
I mean, some of them, yes, they have a lot of experience on Broadway, and that's why they get picked. But in general, it's the hungry, hungry people with a lot of talent and trying to get a career out of that project. And I don't see that happening with the live shows in general. I mean,
again, I don't have a problem with that.
I do, because then you end up with people like Jordan Fisher, who
he is talented. He was marking his vocals. The thing is, Jordan Fisher can sing.
I guess, but anyway, we'll get to that specifically. But I don't know. Most of the time, I feel like they get picked because they're famous and not because they're right for the part or they're talented enough.
Again, I don't have a problem with that. These are television productions, not Broadway productions. They want ratings, so they are going to cast famous people. That doesn't bother me at all.
Right.
It bothers me if those people can't sing or can't handle the work. And we saw this cast. We saw the last number of the production was this cast performing live. We'll get into that whole debacle in a minute. And when I saw them all performing live, I was like, oh, well, there's no doubt. They all could have nailed this.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, people like Vanessa Hudgens, I got no criticism to that girl.
No, she's great.
And of course, Brandon Victor Dixon.
Right.
And so, yes, Jordan Fisher whispered his way through it. And Tinashe did not do such a great job on her vocals either. The guy who played Roger, the guy who broke his foot, I was underimpressed when they were showing the playback, but when they got to his live work at the end, I was like, oh my God, he's really got a voice.
Right.
So I don't think there was any issue with the casting this time around. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing her name right. She wouldn't have been my choice for Mimi. I think when you listen to Daphne Rubin Vega's original OBC version of the character, she sounded rough. That was the thing. Mimi was supposed to look really young, but sound really rough, sound like she had lived a life and that she was hell-bent on self-destruction. And you don't get that from her sort of quavering pop star vocals. And even I would say Rosario Dawson, when she played the part in the movie, she kind of brought that world-weary roughness to it. She didn't bring like a pop star's voice to it. Mimi isn't supposed to sound like a pop star. She's supposed to sound like she's sick and has an addiction and has lived a rough life. Let's, before we move on, I do want to talk about how the whole debacle went down with the a guy breaking his foot and they didn't plan it. But honestly, right now I really feel like I want to talk about my underwear.
All right.
Are you wearing underwear? Mark Skid is curious. What if you could wear the softest, most comfortable underwear you've ever worn, thanks to luxurious, earth-friendly, organic Pima cotton? What if you could wear underwear that upcycled a discarded water bottle and turned it into a silky, smooth waistband? What if, with every pair, $4 was donated on your behalf to save, feed, and cure the world? Well, Mark Skid is a new, and yes, that name is deliberate. Mark Skid is a new underwear company with a mission to make a mark on the world. Mark Skid's belief is simple. Brands should be like the people we love and admire, possess a sense of humor, a strong character, and a purpose in living. Let's make a mark together. You can use checkout code PODCAST for 15% off and free U.S. shipping. One pair of Mark Skid underwear can plant 4 trees, feed a child for 12 days, or delivers $80 in life-saving medical supplies. And Lorenzo, I can attest, it is boldly bright and beautiful,
yes, beautiful
underwear designs
colors.
In these softest cotton. Yeah, really super fun designs. And the fact that they use upcycled water bottles is so awesome, because why should we ever make more virgin polyester when 80% of plastic bottles end up in landfills, right?
Right.
So that's Mark Skid, comfort for you and the world. Go to MarkSkid.com. That's MarkSkid.com. Use checkout code PODCAST for 15% off and free U.S. shipping. Thank you, Mark Skid. Okay, back to Rent Live. The guy who played Roger, Brennan Hunt, broke his foot the night before the show was meant to air live. They didn't have an understudy for him. They didn't have a backup plan. What they did have was a taped performance of the final dress rehearsal.
Right.
And they opted to run that.
Made that decision.
This has got to be one of the worst
decisions.
Live television decisions. This will go down in history as one of the worst live television. To make that choice was just a terrible choice. First off, okay, the fact that he didn't have a understudy is ridiculous, and I suspect that going forward, a lot of these productions are going to have understudies.
Right.
Second, knowing that none of these actors have understudies, and they're shooting the final night's dress rehearsal. They really should not have let anybody hold back on their vocals.
Right, right.
They should have said, listen, guys, this is our backup plan, so you got to sell it.
And that's how dress rehearsals are in general.
You know what? There's been a lot of going back and forth
on this topic
this past week. And some people have said, no, it's very standard for final dress rehearsal to mark your vocals.
That's not true.
Anthony Rapp, who we follow on Twitter, who played the original Mark on Broadway, responded to someone saying that, and he said, no, I never did it that way.
No.
Dress rehearsal, you always did your best.
And most dress rehearsals in New York, they sell tickets for those.
Not only that, people go and
see them.
If you were playing in a company, you would be playing Rent 5-6 nights a week. So
it's
not some crazy thing to ask someone to do a balls-to-the-wall performance 2 nights in a row, because that's what you would be doing if you were playing in theater.
Exactly. That's a very good point. Yeah.
It's not some crazy thing like, oh, they have to save their voices. Well, you know
what?
On Broadway, you don't get
that
chance.
Right.
So that was an enormous mistake. But moving past all of those mistakes in the planning of it, then at the last second, they made the mistake of, should we just do a live version where we just plant the camera and they stand there and they do basically a table read, or should we show them what we shot last night?
Right.
And by all accounts, the live show was electrifying. I've seen bits and pieces of it.
That's what people were saying on Twitter.
That the performances, because this was a bunch of actors who had put their heart and soul into something, and then something completely fucked up at the last second, and they were resorted to having to do with the show this way. This is right out of the Rent story pantheon. It is almost as legendary as the director dying the night before.
Right.
The lead actor literally broke his foot.
I know.
You know, they always say break a leg to actors. So apparently that really fueled their performances, and all of them stood there on their microphones and just sung their hearts out. I saw a couple clips and I was like, oh my God, it would have been weird to tune in that night and not get Rent.
I
honestly think, I know like Matt Zoller Seitz at New York Magazine, TV critic over there, and he made this point where it was like, this would have been like a legendary social media right. thing. Like if you had, people would have been like, oh my God, this is crazy, blah, blah, blah. Instead, they throw up a half-assed, half-baked version with a chyron that says recorded earlier,
right,
even
right,
though
right.
the show's called Rent Live.
And how can you look at that recording and say this is okay to broadcast?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
I mean, Brandon Victor Dixon took it all the way, which that right there, the Broadway professional did not mark right. his
and
vocals.
And Vanessa, apparently nobody told her that it was a
and Vanessa Hutchins, same thing. She's a pro, and she didn't mark her vocals. She completely went balls
but
to the wall.
But it just felt terrible for everybody else, and I feel bad for them because it's just not fair for everybody.
Yeah,
for anybody, the cast, the you know, the audience, everyone, you know, watching
it. And it's such a people were saying like the night it was happening, they were like, you know, they should come back next week and do it. And I'm like, you can't really just like stop rehearsals and then 10 days later come back and do a show. Like you have to stay in right, rehearsals right. to do a show like that. You can't. You can't come back in a month and do it. That's it. They were either going to do it that night or there was no version of it that we were going to get. And honestly, it'll go down as, I think, one of the great bungles.
Right. Whatever
in live
they do
television.
Next, they better be very well prepared.
Yeah. It's such a damn shame.
It is. And I totally agree with you because the whole thing is to be live. So in my opinion, no dress rehearsal should ever be broadcast.
Right.
If there is a problem, get an understudy. Or if that is not a possibility because you want to have all these major actors there, regardless of whatever happens, then have what you said. Have him on a chair the whole time.
Right. Just do a table read. Just have him standing at mics or do a concert.
Whatever. That would be awesome.
Right.
That would be so, like, you know,
I mean, the thing about Rent is the staging of it isn't really that damn important.
Right,
the
right.
sets are not that important. It's the performances and the songs. I've always said that, and I said this to you, you really found the album cacophonous to listen to at times. And I've always said this about Rent. If you haven't seen the live show and you can make sense of some of the songs that do really just sound like cacophonies, It doesn't necessarily work as a recording. It's something mm-hmm. you really do have to experience. You have to experience right. the actors emoting that way. This goes back to my point about earlier when I was sort of critiquing the show, and I didn't get to my real point, which was, despite all its flaws, Rent really delivers on moments. There are moments of the live show that you just cannot deny, even in this this half-baked version that they aired the other day. They're like, you know, Tom Collins' reprise of I'll Cover You, Brandon Victor Dixon had the cast in tears because
right.
that song is amazing at that point in the play. La Vie Boheme. It's
yes.
The funny thing about La Vie Boheme is I listened to it last week because I pulled out my recording. I hadn't listened to it in a while. And I was like, the funny thing about getting old is you now know every reference in La Vie Boheme. And the not so funny thing about getting old is you think a lot of them are really kind of stale, cliched references. It's like, yeah, that's what a 22-year-old thinks is La Vie Boheme. but it's a fun song, and you cannot deny the power of it when the whole cast is doing it.
Right.
Mimi's resurrection in the last 5 minutes of the show is so ridiculous that I can barely sit through it. It is such bad writing. It is such bad acting. But the reprise at the end where they're all saying No Day But Today is like, I have gone to see the live show with, I've taken people to see it and turned to them and they were sobbing at the
mm-hmm.
end. It's an emotional experience over a technically perfect experience.
Right. I totally agree.
And there were times when Rent Live got close to it. Take Me or Leave Me, the song between Maureen and Joanne, which was Vanessa Hudgens and Kiersey Clemons. They nailed that song, and when that song is nailed, it's a fist pump of a song. You can't help but cheer along to it. So Rent has these moments. It's just that as I got older, and I just want to say a little more well-read and sophisticated, I realized that, oh, there's a lot in between these moments of super clumsy songs and weird character turns. And just a slightly goofy idea, Caroline Framke, who writes for Variety, lover, we cite her all the time. And she had a piece about Rent, and she made a really good point that I never considered before, that Jonathan Larson, who wrote it, spent years working in diners as a waiter and shit like that in order to fund his art. So why can't any of his characters get a job as a waiter? Why is it so offensive And her point, I think, was that it puts artists up on a pedestal and doesn't treat them like real people. Artists have to work, and part of your art is, you know, serving diner food so that you can go out and be a performance artist that at night.
Especially in New York and LA.
Exactly. Yeah. So the idea that he had of artists, it wasn't even his own experience of art. So that's why it comes off kind of phony and goofy in retrospect. Oh. Anyway, I think we've talked this to death.
I know.
We've talked this 22-year-old play to death, so now let's talk about a 9-month-old movie or a 6-month-old movie. We finally caught everything okay with the recording?
Yeah.
We are recording. Okay.
No, my God.
We finally caught The Wife, starring Glenn Close. And I have done a lot of talking on Rent, so I am going to let you go.
Well, the funny thing, I sometimes deliberately do not try to find a lot about a movie or about a show or something.
Mm-hmm.
I like to be surprised. So The Wife is one of those instances where I didn't want to know anything about it. I just wanted to watch it. And it was great because, you know, Glenn Close kept getting nominated and winning awards and all that. And I was like, wow, she must be really great because everyone is like praising her like crazy, writing all these pieces about her performance. So we sat down to watch the movie and I wasn't expecting anything, didn't know what the story was. You want to talk about the story?
I want your impressions. All right, fine. I'll tell the story. So you caught me off guard. I just didn't want to talk over you.
No, but it's a story about a couple. You can go ahead. They're both.
I don't want to give away too much of the story.
You can,
except
yeah.
to say that I'll just give my impressions of the film. I don't think we need to recap the story. It's not a great film. In fact, there are parts of the film that are just downright bad. The story is goofy as hell. I thought it was going to be a story. And like Lorenzo, I didn't actually know what unfolded in the story. And I'll say this. The husband is a world-famous and well-celebrated author who wins the Nobel Prize. This all happens in the first few minutes of the movie. And it deals with them going to the award ceremony in Oslo and all these secrets about their marriage tumble mm-hmm. out and all of her pain as his wife tumbles out, along with some stuff, some really goofy side-ass stuff with his son that I did not care about at all. Before I get into any further criticism, and my criticism is minor because the fact of the matter is... I really believe the further I get away from watching it, which was like 4 nights ago, the more I'm starting to think that honestly, Glenn Close's performance may honestly have been one of the all time great cinematic performances.
Yes.
It's that
yes,
good.
Yes.
It's stunningly frickin' good. And she's good. She's always been good. And I had read at least one critic say that he didn't quite understand why everyone was falling in love with this movie because he thought it was very much a standard Glenn Close performance. And in some ways, it's a very standard Glenn Close character. It's like a woman with secrets and a lot of anger. Like Glenn just really, you know, she's good at that stuff. And you could see that as a cliche, but, and like I said, the story's goofy as hell and the directing choices are so bad. Remember that thing I went off on the final shot of the movie,
which
I won't give away. I was like, I cannot believe they did that. That's so lame.
Right.
But my God. And actually the first hour of the film, it's a good Glenn Close performance. And of course, Jonathan Pryce plays her husband. Nothing wrong with that guy.
No,
he's an amazing actor. Not so sure he would have been my first choice to play a New York Jewish intellectual writer. I honestly felt he was struggling a little bit with the accent throughout it. He's English, you know. He wouldn't have been my first choice for that role, but he was pretty amazing in it because you can't deny how good an actor
he
is.
Well, he is a fantastic actor.
Yeah, and they are great together.
Right.
Literally no other performance is worth watching in the film. Max Irons, Jeremy Irons' son, plays their son. It's just such a stupid role because he acts like a 15-year-old, but the actor's like close to 30.
Right.
And the whole time I'm like, grow up. You even said in like the first 40 minutes, you were like, oh my God, I hate everybody in this movie.
Well, that's the thing. The movie is based on a novel, and I'm sure it reads much better than watching it.
Several people told us that.
I'm sure. And the whole time, I didn't know, as I said, I didn't know anything about it. So I turned to you at some point, if you remember, I said, was that a play? Because it does look like a play.
It doesn't feel like a motion picture script.
No, it's staged like a play, and I think it would be much better as a play, to be honest
with
you.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
I think would be a terrific play. And because it's cliche after cliche of everything, everything that happens, you know exactly what's going to go.
And then when there's a weird twist, you're like, they're not really going there,
right,
are they?
Oh my God, are they going to do this? And more points to Glenn Close, because she fights all that and
comes
out as
above
this, as this, I don't know, giant. You know, she's just, her performance is absolutely amazing. And I agree, you recognize her tricks as an actress throughout the entire movie, but you cannot. I mean, you can't.
You know what? Meryl Streep's good at accents.
Right, exactly.
We're not going to take that away from her.
Exactly.
So if Glenn Close is good at rage, give her the rage character.
And she's phenomenal. And, you know, also because she has a lot more experience as an actress now.
Right.
So you can tell, you can just, oh my God, you can just enjoy all of that.
She's just a virtuoso in
this
performance.
Yes, that's
the first
very good
40
way
minutes,
to put it.
It's a really good Glenn Close performance. And then the last hour, it's just like, holy Jesus, what an acting performance this is.
Oh, yes.
There's a scene where she is wordless for several minutes.
Yes.
And the camera is tight on her face as someone else is speaking. And my God. It's like she's screaming her thoughts right into your face, but she doesn't say a word.
Like I said on Twitter, she plays a character with so much shit bottled up, many emotions, many things going on in her head, and you can visually see every single one of them without her even saying anything.
Yeah.
It's an amazing performance. I really, and I'm not even a fan. I mean, I'm not crazy about Glenn Close. I recognize.
I would be happy to see. She has deserved an Oscar for a very long time. I would love to see her, especially since this isn't like Meryl Streep winning an Oscar for playing Maggie Thatcher. This is a goddamn virtuoso. Like she will have deserved this Oscar.
I agree.
It's not a consolation
truly hope
prize.
She wins. Yes.
I was totally rooting for Olivia Colman prior to this, and I still love her performance. But I have to admit, I'm like, no, Glenn Close. She really. She just went on another level of acting. But the film, goofy as hell. My problem
Not a
with
great
the
movie.
Story of the film is that it both the title and somewhat the themes lead you to believe you're looking at the story of some long-suffering wife who had to tamp down on everything so that her husband could be successful. And it is that, but there's such a big twist on it that it just renders the whole story, I don't want to say unsympathetic, but at a certain point you're like, okay, I'm watching people with really specific problems that are kind of grandiose rather than like Glenn has said this when she was accepting awards. She said that she thought of her mother, her own long-suffering mother. And that made me think it was a story about wives and long-suffering wives.
Right.
But I don't think it works as that. I don't want to give anything away. But when you get to what the story is really about, I'm like, no, that's not the experience of most wives. That's a specific thing with this marriage that they chose to do. And it made their marriage very... singular. That I didn't feel like their marriage was a stand-in for other people's marriages because of the nature of it.
And usually those stories tend to portray the wife as the victim. Not that she isn't in this case. I mean, depending on how you read the story.
Well, she kept saying that, which was interesting. She's like, "Don't make me the long-suffering wife in your speeches."
But it's also the decisions you make as a partner.
Exactly.
I think that's a very important element in the movie. The decisions you make as a partner, what you give up, what you gain.
And what you choose to engage in.
What you choose to engage in, exactly, as a partner. So that it's very interesting. And the consequences of it, of course.
Right.
So I think it deals with that really, really well.
It's very nuanced because when her rage comes out, it's justified. And when all the reasons for it come out, it's justified. But it's also like, okay, but.
Right.
Because there is a nuance to it. So it doesn't exactly. It's slightly been pitched as this sort of like universal story of long-suffering wives. But I honestly... Without giving anything away, I'd love to hear what people say who have seen it. So, folks, if you're in our comments section, I'd love to hear some feedback on this. because of the twist, because of what you find out about their marriage, I'm just like, yeah, that's not a stand-in. That's a really unusual marriage. It's fascinating, but this is not a universal story. This is a very specific one.
Right.
Anyway, goofy-ass film, amazing performance.
Right. Like I said, the reason why we're talking about it and that we were eager to watch the movies because she's been nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, she's really on track, and rooting for it. I'm totally on board.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah.
I'd love it if she won.
Yeah, me too. All right, so we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come talk about some politics and current events. We'll be right back.
Talking celebrities, pop culture, TV, and fashion. This is Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We are back on the Opinion Fest, did a little theater, TV, movie talk, which is very cultural of us. I'm very impressed. But now we're going to move on to current events. We really batted around how to talk about this, but in the end, it was like, it doesn't matter where, we have to talk about the fact that Jussie Smollett, star of Empire, was attacked this week in a racist and homophobic attack. Not a racially tinged attack.
Charged.
Racially charged attack, as the press all called it, which I didn't want to get into this on Twitter because, boys, there are times where you just don't want to enter a fray.
But how come
they never say homophobically charged? They have no problem saying a homophobic attack, but, oh, it's got to be a racially charged one. Yeah. Okay, so...
It's a very interesting issue. First, because it's a horrible thing to happen to anyone.
Yes, and a heartbreaking thing.
And it's terrifying that it's happening to, as someone said on Twitter, to a famous actor. And by that, I don't mean that just because, you know, it's horrible to happen to anyone. But we're getting to a point where even famous people are being attacked. Because of the color of their skin and because they're gay. So it's really horrifying. What does that say about, you know, the poor little us, you know,
right.
with not that kind of media attention. So that is really, really frightening. And it's horrifying. I mean, the details are all over the place. We have to address that it's kind of confusing. And I wish the first, I just wish the first statements were a little more detailed and a little more, I don't know.
I'll go there. This is part of the reason why we sort of pulled back on commentary is because we gave our support to Jussie on social media immediately
right.
and called it out. And then I spent that day retweeting a bunch of African-American and LGBTQ people of color who had thoughts on the matter because I really wanted to center their voices and not make it about us. On the other hand, I did say that day on Twitter that you were at the gym and it was starting to get dark out and I was just worried. I was like, these things, you know, it's not, to make that clear, it's not that I thought, oh, just a famous person got attacked in Chicago, so that means that all gay people are getting attacked everywhere today. Obviously, that's not what I meant, but it's just a reminder. That's what hate crimes do, is that they ripple outward and they remind all these people in these overlapping communities that they are at risk, that there are people out there who want to destroy them just because of what they are. So a lot of queer folks and a lot of people of color were feeling the rippling outward effects of that attack. I mean, one of the details of the attack is that they wrapped a noose around his neck, and I just saw black person after black writers and influencers and pundits saying the same thing over and over and over again. The thought of that happening to me, I cannot imagine that happening to me and how traumatizing that would be. Which leads me into my point, is that Jussie Smollett, in the manner of so many victims of violent crimes, did not act like a perfect victim. And so now people are questioning. And I'm not questioning his attack. I'm not questioning any of his points. But I am noting that the story, as it was reported, details kept changing. And that was the press's fault. That wasn't Jussie Smollett's fault. And then It came out that the police couldn't, they had already reviewed hundreds of hours of CCTV footage and they couldn't really find anything. And they briefly noted that there were two men on the camera, but they couldn't find them doing anything or that sort of thing. There was a lack of any sort of evidence. Jesse claimed to have been speaking on the phone with his manager, and his manager claims to have heard them saying something about "Welcome to MAGA Nation" or something like that, which immediately cast the crime in a partisan political light. All gay bashings are political, but when you're talking about "Make America Great" hats or whatever, "Make America Great" slogans, it immediately becomes partisan. But then Jesse would not turn over his phone to the police so that they could check this phone call. So I'm not casting the slightest bit of doubt on the fact that something happened to Jesse. I'm just saying that as social media figures, right, and commenters, we decided to pull back on talking about it until this was settled a little bit more. Like I said, victims don't act perfect in the first 24 to 48 right, hours. They get details wrong, or they might shut down and not want to deal with the police or whatever. So I'm willing to wait to cast any sort of, but the fact of the matter is this has been politicized. So, and as soon as Make America Great Again became part of it, there were people, it was like the boys, the Covington Catholic High School boys. It was exactly the same thing.
I was just about to say that, that a video was released and then immediately everyone had an opinion about it without, I mean, honestly, to me, just looking at that picture or the video, I mean, I made my own decision.
It was a bunch of white boys doing tomahawk chops to an elderly native man. Right. There is no question.
There is no question there. But my point is that the social media just ran with it. And that's what's been happening now with social media. They just run with anything, with a tiny bit of information. And that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and creating fake news and fake facts. Fake fact machine that you start believing what you're reading on social media.
If you follow, you know, entertainment news of any sort, you might have read earlier or late last year that it came out that the Ghostbusters movie, the reboot with the women cast, which became very controversial amongst, misogynists online, Russian bot networks got involved in order to drum up arguments. And I'm just going to say it. I'm someone who lives online, who observes social media a lot, and I see these trends play out over time. And I don't want to sound like I have a tinfoil hat on my head, but folks, everything now has been politicized by bot networks. And I'm not pointing at the Russians for everything, although I think they're a good shot. It happened with the Covington Catholic thing. It happened with Ghostbusters. It's happening with this Jesse Smollett thing, where if you mention his name on social media, you are going to get slammed with trolls who are all claiming that he made it up, who all want to see evidence, blah, 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 blah. And they all have like 8-digit numbers after their names and registered in the last 6 months.
Right. I mean, it's very clear now that fake news work. I mean, we have the biggest example, which is a president elected.
Yeah.
It works, and they are...
And it's everywhere now.
It's everywhere now, and they keeps getting better and perfecting it.
I'm just telling people, you really need to be aware of
that. You just have to be careful, and maybe you want to collect a few more facts or statements.
And don't engage with these people at all. Right, they're bots. Right. Their entire reason of existing is to drum up, hatred, is to drum up anger and hatred, is to get people tearing at each other's throats, and is to make people question what's right in front of their eyes all the time.
I mean, we're very, very
it's
careful.
There to sow confusion. And I just want to say that another example of this, taking it over, is it's been very clear in the last couple of weeks there are Russian, I cannot believe I'm saying this out loud, but it is true. Please, I mean, go look. There are Russian bots out there who are attacking any reports on Meghan Markle. I know that sounds crazy, but they are latching onto any slightly controversial cultural figure and drumming up as much anger and as many arguments as they can. So right now the thing on Meghan Markle is it's gone beyond just, oh, she violates protocol, or even like mild forms of...
She closed her own door.
Or the racism that underlies a lot of her criticism, and has just become way more overt that she's a whore. And she's fooling the whole family, and she's wearing a pillow. She's not really pregnant. This, we got swarmed with bots yesterday on the Meghan Markle post about how she's wearing a pillow and she's lying to the whole family. And yeah, and all this stuff about her sister and her father. They just grab this stuff and they run with it because they know Americans get all caught up in these cultural arguments. I don't know. I'm not your daddy. I'm not here to tell you what to do. But I, as someone who spends so much time online and on social media, I don't engage with that crap even a little bit. The minute that happens, block and walk away. Engaging gives it power. And once you realize that there is a 99% chance that the anonymous person on the other side of this argument is just there to drum up shit, then what's the point in engaging them?
Right.
Anyway, to take this back to Jussie Smollett, the swarms have descended. It's become extremely politicized, and Jussie is acting like a victim acts after a crime, which is not, you know, like someone in a SVU episode.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's it. That's the story. Our hearts go out to him. Our hearts go out to everyone who was affected by this. Any LGBTQ people, any people of color, any marginalized people in this nation who have felt at risk and who have felt a heightened feeling of risk in the last several years. And I will, folks, I don't care who you voted for. If you're gay, if you're black, if you're Muslim, if you're Latinx, you have felt it in the last 2 years. You felt it. We've all felt it. It's not imaginary. Gay man in Philadelphia was just jumped a couple days, the same day or the day after Jussie Smollett. These things are happening with more and more frequency.
And two guys in Texas, they were holding hands and they were attacked. It's also on Twitter if you want to read about
it. And then a transgender woman was killed the transgender woman of color was killed the other day. And I mean, we don't even note when transgender people, we're trying to become better allies and better members of the LGBTQ family by noting these things more.
The thing
when
is
our transgender sisters or our non-binary transgender friends are killed or hassled, we have to stand up for that as much as we would any white gay couple who got beat up for holding hands.
Right, go
ahead.
The thing is that we live in a culture, we live in a country where role models are a very important thing. So, or people in power stating certain things. People just go for that. So when you say that there are good people and bad people on both sides, you know, you opening up a door, a gate, and that stays open for a long time, and it causes a lot of damage, and you just have to be very, very careful with that. That's just the reality of it. It's not that these people didn't exist before, but now they are.
They have an agenda.
They have an agenda,
organized.
And they have some sort of support.
And you need to ignore them. Just walk away from any of these. There is no point in arguing about whether Meghan Markle is pregnant online with strangers. So walk away from it, no matter what they say. You're not calling anything out. You're not solving a problem. You're doing exactly what they are wanting you to do, what their jobs are designed to get you to do.
Yeah.
Walk away from it. Always walk away from it. That's my advice. Moving on to our final topic. Well, I do want to say, I reiterate this point, though, about Jussie and about hate crimes. No matter who you are, when something happens that affects communities like that, if you're not a member of that community, try and be mindful of that. Try and be aware of that. Try and reach out to those people in your community that you know who might be feeling something from these events. And not to pat ourselves on the back, but I remember when the Kavanaugh hearings were going on and Dr. Ford had to do her testimony, we were very aware of how this was affecting women around us. And we tried to reach out and we tried to be good allies on that day because we knew it was hard for them. And it's the same thing. Reach out to your LGBTQ friends. Right. I mean, even privileged white gay guys like us were feeling it that day. We're feeling that feeling of fear, that feeling of dehumanization. We retweeted something the other day about someone who said anybody who had a car full of people scream faggot at them as they drove by. And we have, like everybody, every gay or queer people, we have many, many times.
Oh, my God. And those things scar.
Oh, yes. Over time, they do. They do. Because you think, is this car going to stop and they're going to get out with tire irons? What's going to happen?
Yes, I still remember when a car stopped at a traffic light and they turned to me and they said, are you what they call a homosexual? And I never forgot that. It was so traumatized. I was shaking when they left. And, you know, it just disturbed my whole day. And, that happened many, many years ago and I still think about it.
Yeah, it's meant to scare you. It's meant to dehumanize you. So reach out to your folk when things like that happen. They need your allyship, and they need someone to say that you're thinking of them. Okay, moving on to slightly less serious topics. And it's really just our final topic, which is fashion and politics. It's coming up yet again. Just got news this morning that the House Democratic Women's Working Group is inviting female members of both parties to wear white to the State of the Union address next week. We actually got a reach out from a journalist who wants to talk to us about it. So we might actually be talking to her next week. But this just goes hand in hand with what we've been. It'll be interesting. First off, it'll be interesting to see if women of both parties are going to show up wearing white. I suspect it'll be mostly Democratic women.
Right.
It would be lovely if the Republican members of the House showed up in white.
Well, it would be lovely if they did a lot of things, but
yeah, we won't get into that. So it's, you know, this, it's really interesting how the white pantsuit has become this iconic political uniform for white, for political women. I think Hillary got it started. I really don't think anyone was doing that prior to her. So, I mean, I think we all need to give her her due. She really did start this iconic fashion statement in leftist women politics.
Right.
That was a tip of the hat to the suffragette women, suffragette movement, and very feminist in tone because it's a pantsuit, which has a much more feminist undertone to it than, say, a dress or a skirt. And, you know, we're not going to get too far into this. Do you have thoughts about this?
No, but I think it's great. I think any little or minor show of support, which is, you know.
I just think it's interesting how especially political women, are becoming much more adept at using fashion.
Right.
Hillary is no fashionista, but she actually started this iconic moment of white pantsuits. And Melania, I got to say, picked it up. She was the first one to redo it when she showed up, I think, for the first State of the Union address in a white pantsuit. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has worn them. I don't know if Nancy Pelosi has worn them, but Nancy, she got other various things started, like that Max Mara coat of hers became this iconic fashion moment because, you know, she was photographed walking out of the White House wearing it.
The bottom line is that
when she took over the gavel, she wore a bright pink dress, very much in the color of the Pussy Hat resistance movement. Go ahead.
I think the main thing here is that people will be talking about you. And if it's through fashion, why not?
Yes.
Why not? As long as people are talking and engaging into, you know, in a conversation about whatever topic is.
I look at it this way. Part of the consequence of women gaining the levers of power is that they are going to wield power like women, which doesn't mean. I'm really only looking at this on a surface level. If for this part of the conversation, it means they are going to modern political women are starting to realize that fashion is a tool.
Right.
And they're indulging it and using it because political men don't really get it as an option. They are all going to wear blue suits, white shirts, and red or blue ties. That's it. That's the uniform. And women are gaining levels of power now and levels of scrutiny in politics. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, my God, I don't know how she's handling the spotlight.
Oh, my God.
But she's well aware. Like, her Instagram talks about her lipstick brand, and she gives beauty tips and stuff like that. And everybody's making fun of her for being a millennial, and I'm like, you need to wake the F up. This is how millennials communicate. This is why she's electrifying her base.
And this whole thing that an intelligent or experienced or professional woman can't talk about fashion, it is a form of suppression in a way because
it was an old feminist idea that is now moving away.
To me, it's some it's a form of suppression anyway, because you're telling this woman that she can't enjoy fashion, right, enjoy trivial things, and be a brilliant woman at the same time, which is...
In some ways, I totally agree. And in some ways, I feel like Nancy Pelosi's bright pink dress on the day she took the gavel was more significant than any of these moments, only in the sense that, well, first off, she's the most powerful woman in the United States. She's the most powerful woman in United States history. But she's 78, and if you look back at her career as a politician, she was always a stylish woman, but she was not someone who used fashion in politics, and she pretty much hewed the straight and narrow of, like, suits in neutral colors with maybe a scarf and a nice coat. But for a 78-year-old woman to come out in a shocking pink dress,
right,
means that she learned that lesson. She's 78, and she learned that lesson, and she's happy to take it up. She's happy to take it up. This idea that what I wear sends a message,
right,
as much, not as powerful, but in many ways as important as what I do. And she's learning how to wield that. Paul Ryan could have never stepped, no Speaker of the House could have ever worn shocking pink anything to gain that gavel. But by her doing that, she's very much drawing attention to her womanhood in that role. And she's not dumb. She's doing it on purpose. So this whole thing about white suits at the State of the Union is a great idea, and we'll see how it works out. But I'm actually really loving how fashion and politics are intersecting so much. And it's not on a shallow level. It's on a semiotic level. We're not talking about whether or not the female members of Congress are, you know, trendy or wearing the latest styles. We're talking about how they're using their fashion to send messages their politics.
Right.
And that's really powerful and exciting, and I really like that. All right, so Lorenzo is closing his laptop and making all sorts of finger gestures at me, so I guess we're wrapping things up.
Oh, my God. Too much information.
Mm-hmm. All right, so kittens, that's us podpurring our...
Lorenzo left the room.
Yeah, Lorenzo's gone, so I'm going to wrap up for things. Yeah, he's packing his bags. He's on his way to the gym in 5-degree weather.
Oh, my God, you're terrible.
Okay, kittens, we love you. We thank you so much for listening to our cartoon voices for another week. Please like us on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram, or follow us on those things. And that's it. Have a lovely week. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.